So it's really I want to thank really our speakers again, Dr. Friedman and Rabbi Weinreb here in this room, and really it's been a pleasure having them and learning with them and from them all weekend, and thank you very much, and we look forward to the ending off with a bang. So we'll let you take over. Bakasha.
Okay, I'm going to prepare actually. Now I didn't take some notes on what people say, but okay, whatever. All right. So this is a topic of boundaries and borders for physicians and other health professionals that's very near and dear to me. And I got involved in this topic. I want to give credit to some authors who really influenced me, really in my work at Yeshivat Chovevei Torah, because the whole area of preparing rabbis to be aware of boundaries and to be thoughtful about what might be, what's the difference between boundary crossing. Oh, by the way, if you want to look along, my speaking notes are on page 165. So that's kind of the rough outline. And I'm just going to put it here. And you can kind of fill it in. So really what I want to set up as kind of my overall point of view is, generally speaking, let me just step back for a moment. I would say both rabbis and certainly people in the medical field, for us to be effective, and I'm using us broadly, we need to come in close to our patients' lives. We need to be hover in a space that I think really has a sacred component to it, and we need to honor it. In order for people to feel comfortable exposing vulnerabilities, sharing confidences, talking about things that are difficult for them, that they often feel are very humiliating, we need, and I'm talking we here broadly, and I would include rabbis. Certainly Dr. Rabbi Weinreb is a rabbi, but I think this applies both to rabbis and to people in the medical and mental health profession. We are creating a special kind of protected, safe place so that people, as I said, can divulge difficult information and can receive, hopefully, a sense of caring. I think, as Rabbi Weinreb said yesterday, advice is last on the list. But in a way, it's creating that sacred space where we can hold our patients' confidences, provide that compassionate, active listening space. And hopefully, I just want to mention something that I became aware of a couple of weeks ago. I gave a talk up at Harvard for the combined Harvard chaplains. And I got a wonderful email afterwards from the Quaker minister, or whatever he would be called, chaplain, who informed me about something which I had not known before, which is called the Clearness Committee. And basically what Quakers do, they don't really have they have no hierarchy in their religious structure. But if somebody has a problem in their community, they convene a meeting of three people designated from the community, and they basically sit with that person. And there is an understanding of confidentiality, and they sit with that person for a significant chunk of time, and that person talks out his or her issue. It could be marital, it could be financial, it could be, turning point in life, whatever it is. And the idea basically is creating that listening environment with caring, actively engaged people who might reflect, might suggest whatever, but the idea is, in the Quaker Clearness Committee, that you will find the way. Now, we don't use that language exactly, but I think we often do provide that a great deal of the time. However, for that sacred space to exist, we need to have parameters that protect it. And I know most of the time, it's the sort of man bites dog thing of sexual boundary violations, like the uh-oh of what happens when a rabbi crosses some boundary, there's a slippery slope, gets involved sexually with a congregant, and the same would be true for doctors, and that is like, the uh-oh, we're really worried about that kind of thing. Now, I say to my students, yes, I do care about that, and not only is that definitely a wrong thing, and by the way, I'm taking the point of view in that particular problem for the purposes of this session, and in general, I take this point of view, that while I do think there are, sociopathic, kind of pathologically malignant characters who seek the teaching profession or seek medicine or seek the rabbinate because they are looking for vulnerable persons to prey on in this way, I do truly believe that that's the minority. I think that the people who run into problems with sexual boundary violations are usually good people who are in a dark place in some point in their life where their own personal relationship is not going well, their marriage is in a dark place, they have a sense of failure about their life, something has gone wrong, there is a moment of vulnerability, there is a congregant or a patient who has an idealized transference to that professional, you know, there's a little bit of a slip, the slip goes further, there's a car ride someplace, going to a conference, an evening consultation, whatever it happens to be, and things kind of go from there. So yes, I am concerned about protecting the sanctity of the relationship from that point of view. I'm certainly concerned about the reputation and the actual conduct of my rabbinical students and certainly doctors. But I also am looking at this for how do you overall, out before boundary violations of age, you know, legally dangerous and all sorts of other dangerous ways, how do you protect that space so that over time you can maintain it in yourself in a way that really enhances and furthers this work? Because as I said, here's my blurb, how physicians and other providers negotiate boundaries in this intimate zone depends on role perception, the regulation of power and confidentiality. And one of my premises is that in the physician-patient relationship, even if your patient is smarter than you, has more advanced degrees than you, whatever, in that doctor-patient relationship, there is always, just as there is in a rabbinic relationship, a power differential. In that relationship, you are, let me just use a kind of whatever term, you are the grown-up in the room. The person is looking to you for care, for advice, for some kind of definition, and I think we have a sacred obligation to respect that. You know, like I was saying yesterday for people who were in, I think it was the session 34, the balloons went up and we all like fled into the lawn to watch the balloons, that we have to monitor even the, I'll get to time, but we, meaning the physicians, the healthcare providers, need to monitor the time that we're spending, whatever that amount of time is, and be mindful towards the end of that session to help that person, kind of like I said before, re-regulate, to be able to leave the office or the hospital room or whatever it is, and exit with a sense of re-equilibrium to getting back to their life. The other thing that I want to say, which I think is really true of, there are a couple of things, of healthcare providers, and which is true of rabbis, is less true of mental health professionals in large cities, but for those of you who are in smaller communities, you are in this pickle as well, is that you live and work with the people you are treating. Now, me in Manhattan, you know, on 70th and West End, has the luxury, you know, when some person calls up and says, well, I'd like to come and talk with you. I have a real problem, this is a true story, with my daughter. And my daughter, she tells me her daughter is a teacher at Ramaz. Now, at that time, I had a child who was in school at Ramaz, and I could say, you know, I do have a kid in this school, and I think in a world of many mental health providers in Manhattan, it would be better for you to go see somebody who blah, blah, blah. Now, if you're in Ottawa, maybe you can't do that. Maybe you really are the best provider, or for whatever the circumstances happen to be. So even the mental health people in the room, you know, this anonymity or this, you know, kind of, it's quite relaxing to not have to socially engage with your patients, because I think that poses a whole lot of other challenges. But certainly physicians and mental health providers and obviously rabbis are constantly interacting socially with their congregants and their patients. So I think that the need for a boundary awareness and a regulation, and I'm using that in respect, the parameters that I'm talking about, this list of what I hope being helpful for you to be mindful of ways that you want to think about chaperoning this sacred relationship. Well, like I said the other day, there are very few things. I do feel that people have to find their own level of what's comfortable for them. And there are a number of other things on this list that I, you know, will say, look, you find your way. There's a couple of like real no-nos or real absolutes that I'll let you know what I think about. But I definitely feel that this is an area where you need to find, you know, what kind of works for you. Okay, so let me just also give credit. I got the authors who were the very, very helpful for me were Thomas Gutheil and Glenn Gavard. For those psychiatrists in the room, and certainly you're at Harvard, I believe that Gutheil is at Harvard, and he wrote a paper which had to do with boundary crossings. That team has written a number of papers having to do with boundary crossing, boundary violations, both in person, on the internet, whatever, for mental health professionals. So in my work with rabbis, I in talking about this and spending a lot of time on this topic, there's no shortage of boundary violations, which are unspeakably damaging both to the people who are directly involved, but also to the larger Jewish olam and to the other religious faith. I mean, you know, who hasn't opened a paper in the last bunch of years to read about yet another enormous payout or scandal or whatever in the Catholic Church? And I'm sure that this exists. And again, my premise is that these are not in large bad guys, but people who have are exposed to a tremendous amount of powerful material and have walled off their own awareness of themselves, and it kind of festers in some dark secret place, and people split this part off from themselves, and so when they're acting out this, they're kind of, you know, whatever they're rationalizing is, it's okay, I'm helping this person find love, you know, whatever it is, they're somehow, in the way that not terrible people do terrible things, they're splitting off that part of themselves. And I think it really requires a kind of work to not do that. So they wrote a bunch of articles, which I adapted. Now, I did put the article in, I thought about this, but in the binder that you've had, I didn't put, maybe I should have, I don't know, the article that I wrote for this, it was a chapter for this book called, kind of a, the title is A Tempest in the Temple. And it's about, it's put out by Brandeis. I think the author, the editor is, I forgot her name now, Amy Newstein, I think. Anyway, it was a whole article about rabbinic boundary violations. And my chapter is called Crossing the Line, How Rabbis Can Prepare for, Recognize, and Deal with Sexual Conflicts and Boundary Violations. So a lot of it has to do with the program that I set up at YCT, and I felt that, it seemed like a little bit too much self-promotion for this content. But if you do want the article where I kind of adapt Gutheil and Gavard stuff for the rabbinate, and I did show the article to Gutheil, who was so supportive and so happy that his work and his and Gavard's, kind of basic outline was being used for the rabbinate, it was really very lovely. But if you want to email me at mefriedman@gmail.com, I'm happy to send you that article. Okay, so I wanted to start off with clarifying the term. And what are boundaries? It's sort of like, I probably used this the other day, it had to do with something else, but, the famous line from the Supreme Court is about pornography. I can't exactly define it, and I know it when I see it. But what is a boundary? We think of it as kind of a line that separates proper from improper behavior. But I'd like to expand that or extend that to the notion of a boundary. What's the difference between a boundary crossing and a boundary violation? Because sometimes, as you know, like let's say for the rabbinate or for a doctor, it would not be typical. Let's say you're working with a very difficult, we were just talking about, we were talking before about being a hospitalist in Ottawa. So let's say you're working with a very difficult adolescent. And the adolescent is, fidgety, ADD, whatever it is. And so you feel like sitting in a more formal one-on-one, in your office is really not going to work. So you say, why don't we go out and shoot some hoops? Or why don't we go out and take a walk? Now, that would not be a typical psychiatric setting. Now, maybe if you're an adolescent psychiatrist, it would be. But let's say somebody says, you're working on a, some kind of event, and the patient says, or somebody says, well, we need to go pick up the party supplies. And you say, well, let's go do that. And you go on a drive, you go for a walk. That certainly wouldn't be a typical, way of meeting or discussing something with your patient. But it wouldn't be, I would consider that a boundary crossing, meaning that would it be outside the more typical realm of, you know, a psychiatric or a medical context. Let's say somebody says to you, you know, doctor, now this has other things about in terms of infringing on your personal space, but let's say somebody brings up something in a social setting, or you're on a, I don't know, you're on a hike or something, and somebody starts talking to you about symptoms that they are worried about. And, you know, while you kind of are like, oh, I have to bring this up, like, you know, while I'm outside, but you also sort of feel like, well, maybe this is important that I listen to. And you start engaging in a kind of a question and answer thing, and you're really in the process of a kind of medical interview. That certainly wouldn't be typical. I would consider that a boundary crossing. It might be the exact right thing to do for that person. That might be, you know, really the most helpful, the most opportune use of a moment, and it really might help segue into a relationship or a next step that maybe is more conventionally organized or whatever, but really helps this person address a problem, and you are the point person that's guiding them along to it. So what's the difference between a boundary crossing and a boundary violation? Any thoughts? I definitely and Gavard have a really neat answer. But what do we consider a boundary violation? Any takers from the audience? Any just, you know,
sexual interaction in the office?
A sexual interaction.
Power differential.
Okay, certainly. I would definitely agree with the power differential violation. And sexual boundary violations are by far in the main what get people in trouble. But there are also financial, indiscretions, exploitations. Financial exploitations, I think, are really not discussed as much, and other kinds of maybe abuses of confidentiality. So while I think sexual is the main, I wouldn't say that exclusively. Yes? Yes, something that you wouldn't want somebody else to know. I find that really, really helpful. Mainly, like, if you don't want to tell anybody it, if you think I better keep this a secret, you are in boundary violation territory. And I think that is I find that a really useful personal barometer index, you know, to be paid attention to. And as I told my students once, I've told them this a million times, I think it's like imprinted on their brains, you know, take your own emotional pulse. I mean, really, this is just a different way of saying be tuned in to the countertransference. But you guys have had, you know, exposure to that language. Most people who come to communal programs haven't, although they get familiar with it by the time they're done with me. But taking your own emotional pulse is in a way a punchier way of saying be tuned in, because really, in the personal regulation, you know, your gut is your stethoscope. You know, your gut is your blood pressure monitor. That is what you use. What I tell my students all the time, you know, we all have a kind of regular sine wave of response, of how we're responding in the medical interview, in the medical consultation. And, you know, you kind of generally, there's a sort of a hum between, let's say, whatever, here and here. You want to pay attention to when you're here or when you're here. When there's something that agitates you or moves you or provokes you to really feel like you want to lean into the situation, like you feel really connected, and also when you feel like a real repulsion or a real pulling away from the patient. When you're outside of your normal therapeutic, professional sine wave of response to it in your medical, obviously it's medical, generally speaking, work, you want to pay attention to that, because there's something that is going on there. Either this person is eliciting some powerful kind of countertransference reaction in you, maybe they're doing it unconsciously, intentionally, maybe they're doing it consciously, intentionally, whatever. Your job as the grown-up, as the professional in the room, is to pay attention. And similarly, it's not just for the bright spots, like the, wow, I really feel, you know, drawn to this patient. And obviously, if you find yourself dressing up a little bit more, putting on perfume or cologne, you know, looking in the mirror unusually before seeing a certain patient, you want to pay attention to that. But you also want to pay attention to when you feel like, ooh, I'd like to shorten this session, you know, can I get out of it, whatever. What is it that's eliciting powerful reactions? So I would like to say, would anybody want to add to, if you don't want to let anybody know, you are probably in boundary violation territory? you know, you acted on a stock tip, you don't really want to tell anybody about that. You know, you felt like you sort of, you know, when you shook the patient's hand or whatever it was, there was a kind of caress that felt a little something. You know, whatever it happens to be. Yes, please.
Last week, I was shocked almost. I was waiting in the doctor's office, and there was another guy there, and the nurse, this nurse slash receptionist recognized me. And she says, "Are you family good?" And she starts telling him about his brother's medical situation.
Okay, right.
And my wife and I really do a gasket.
Yeah. By the way, I want to just bring this up. I have seen this in, like, virtually every doctor's office I've gone to. This is a terrible problem with doctor architecture, office architecture. You're sitting there in the waiting room, waiting for your appointment, and the person behind the desk who has authority is calling up the pharmacy and pulling in Yenem's Viagra,
right.
Yenem's, you know, whatever it happens to be. The lack of confidentiality,
yes,
because of the architecture of offices is horrifying. They're yelling out the person's name, the medication, the dosage, just whatever it happens to be. If it's methotrexate or Viagra, it's nobody else's business. And it is really something that we have to pay attention to.
I mean, it's a HIPAA violation. You cannot do that.
It's a HIPAA violation in the States also, but it's still done because of the way the offices are set up.
It's
terrible.
I guess one of my questions came out of it was, well, if it's a close relative, does that make it okay? And then my wife reminded me, and I said, you know, but how do we know that he wants to, you know, he has to determine who
right.
has access to that.
Right. Okay, so moving along, because I really want to pay attention to time, the role. I think something we always want to be thinking about is, you know, what is our role in this situation? You know, what is your role as a doctor, as a nurse, as a therapist, as a, you know, physical therapist, whatever it happens to be? Is this what a physical therapist does? Is this what a GP does? Is this what a radiologist does? You know, so I think that, and it will depend a lot. So if a, you know, if somebody, sometimes requests or expectations vary very much, even though the title might be the same, depending on what your role is and how you perceive it, the nature of the interaction is going to change. I said, what is the professional feeling when with this client? Okay, I talked about taking your emotional health. Number three, time. Time defining the visit. And this is a very big deal for rabbis. I think with physicians, given, you know, the nature of how structured time usually is, that is often maybe too circumscribed. But let's say in situations where it's not, I believe it is imperative, not just, but certainly also, for the maintenance of your own life, so that your life is, you know, your day is progressing. And if you have a patient who, you know, I don't know if this is true in Canada, but in the United States, it's routine and horrible that when you go to the doctor, you've got to build in like an extra hour because you don't know when your ophthalmologist or your gynecologist or your dermatologist is going to see you. Now, yes, they have emergencies and this and that, but they're also overscheduling patients, blah, blah, blah. However, when a person walks in, I think it is imperative to say, you know, hello, Mrs. White, we have about 20 minutes. We have about 30 minutes. Now, obviously, if you're a psychiatrist, psychotherapist, the time is usually defined. They know they have 45 minutes. So they know, in the famous, if they bring up some very important matter at the 44th minute, there is some meaning to that. And it is not that you should, that you're, whatever, however dramatic the thing is, if they bring it up in the 44th minute, there is meaning to that. They want to bring it up at the end so there isn't scary to them, whatever. And you know, Mrs. White, it is striking that you brought it up at the final moment. Perhaps this is something very difficult to talk about, and let's either schedule another session or we'll bring it up at the beginning of the next time or whatever. You know, if somebody just got a horrible diagnosis of a malignant melanoma and they're telling you that in the 44th minute, maybe you don't want to wait until 2 weeks from now. But there is some meaning in that that is definitely begging for exploration, but it doesn't mean that you are then going to keep the next guy waiting for half an hour or whatever it happens to be. I very much advocate, whatever the amount of time is, that you are mindful of the clock in the sense that if your session is 15 minutes or 25 minutes or whatever, like I said before, I used the analogy yesterday in my famous pre-balloon talk, that it's like, you know, going for deep sea diving. You can't come up quickly, because if you don't give all the old-fashioned way, you know, if you don't give enough time for the nitrogen to equilibrate, people get to bend, which is obviously a very crippling condition. And I believe that that analogy holds true for the emotional aspect of the physician-patient contact. That if somebody gets deep into some very powerful material, they need to come up and re-equilibrate to room air before leaving and going on with their life, especially if they're going to see you in the community. You know, even if they're not, they got to get out there and do their thing, but certainly when they're going to see you, maybe they're going to see you in Minion later in the day, or they're going to see you at the school PTA meeting, or whatever it happens to be. But you want to regulate, you want to say, you know, we have about 5 minutes left. I want to give you time to, you know, kind of brush the sun off, to think about what to do next. Whatever your language is, I think it is really important to monitor the time. Something that comes up all the time now, certainly phone calls. Phone call time and absolutely cyber time is not free time. And texting is another thing. Gundel and Gavard have written volumes on texting, or whatever, a lot of articles anyway, on texting and on the use of the internet. I'm not talking about, you know, the pernicious use of it. I'm talking about emailing people. Number one, I think it's very important. I think email can be an incredibly convenient and helpful way for people to be in contact. You know, aside from, you know, the convenience of establishing appointments or whatever it happens to do, and I with full respect to HIP, I certainly don't think we should ever communicate emotionally loaded material over the internet. I never think you should be giving a diagnosis or pathology report or whatever online. That is like a bad idea. However, sometimes people, and certainly people at a distance, and I get this with my students, with their kids in Israel particularly, you know, who are abroad, have a relationship with maybe it's an NCSY rabbi, or it's somebody from a youth group, or whatever it happens to be, and that contact from a distance can feel safer, and they can divulge material. Now, I think that can be an extraordinarily powerful tool. However, I think people have to be mindful that it takes time to read emails, and it takes time to write emails, and that doesn't just exist in the ozone. And I do think it's important for people to be aware that time is something to be respected, and that when you are sending communications at odd times, it's like meeting with a patient at 11:30 or 2 a.m. I don't think, except for an emergency room or the unbelievably rare circumstance, there is no good reason for a healthcare professional to meeting with a patient privately at 2:30 in the morning. That is like a setup. Maybe that's not a boundary violation, but boy, it could easily be interpreted on the way there. Because anything that's special, that makes people feel that they're outside, this was talked about earlier, outside, you know, the general regular flow of a professional life has a lot of potential danger. It's fraught with danger. So if you happen to be up in the morning because your baby wakes up, or, you know, you watched a lot of reruns or whatever, or you're learning, or you're preparing, or whatever, and that's your habit, and you happen to go, as we all often do, because we are very attached to our electronic devices, and we want to see if people want to write to us, and if we're important, and all that stuff that's involved with that. That could be like a whole other, not just session, but a whole conference. And we happen to look online at 2:30, and you see that so-and-so wrote me this poignant email. If you decide to write back, do not press send at 2:30 in the morning. Okay, that's what absolute. Press send at 8:30 the next morning. Because I really think that the good that you do in what you wrote, assuming that it's, you know, very helpful, whatever, is quite, it's not necessarily undone, but it's made turbulent and complicated by the stamp of 2:30 in the morning. Because it kind of feels weird, like it's exciting, and it's titillating, and it's weird. You know, why is my doctor, like, involved with me at this time of the day? And I think we want to send that message. Similarly, I think if there's a volume of email, a volume of texting, you really want to limit it. People should not feel that they have unlimited access. And this has to do both with protecting, you know, if you resent the intrusions that patients make on your life, you are not going to be rendering great care. You know, you're going to feel like, oh, get away from me, you're taking over my life. And we have to establish those boundaries. So I think, and I really implore you to talk about this with your trainees as well, your residents, you know, whoever it is. Did somebody have a thought about, to do this. Place and space, number four. I think this is, you know, again, this is in the area of maybe doing something outside the conventional space is exactly the right thing, but you need to be mindful about the place and the space that you're occupying. So if you're going to the home of somebody who's quite, who cannot make it to the hospital, you're making a home visit, and the person is not desperately ill, I would encourage to have that visit not be in the patient's bedroom. Because I do want to make the point that I think that the possibility, we want to give people the full spectrum of the benefit and the respect of their humanity. And we do not want to deny that the very elderly or the very sick have sexual, intimate, longing feelings. If anything, they might even have the wish for that, not that they can act it, enact it even more, because there's a yearning for that spark of vitality. So when I say if the person can get out of their bed, obviously, I'm not saying, if the person is desperately sick and is lying in bed, don't go to their bedroom, that would be ridiculous. But if the person can put on their robe and come to their living room, I think that establishes a very different kind of rapport that is a much more, this is not my area of expertise, but certainly the Rambam is talking about visiting the sick, and it talks about the level at which, physically, the level at which you're supposed to be at with your patient, and you really want to establish the patient's dignity and the parity with that patient as much as possible. Again, you're the doctor, you're certainly in the power position. But certainly, sometimes, I use this vignette often, a person calls you up in the middle, it's late at night, it's 11:15, and the woman calls you sobbing from the car, this is a rabbinical student, because her husband has just told her that he's leaving her for whatever, and she is desperate, and her kids are with her, whatever, and she drives over, she has to talk to you. What do you do? So there's all kinds of different solutions. There's no solution. There are different ways of dealing with, working with this situation. If the Rebbetzin is home, if somebody is home, the person's coming in, what are you going to do? Can you go to an all-night Starbucks? Can you get it out of, whatever? But I think that being mindful of the place and space, how it's set up, is very important. Of course, I don't think it needs to be said, but maybe it's always worth saying that I think when somebody comes into an office space, and let's say it's not even your office space, let's say you happen to be meeting in somebody else's office or in a conference room, you really want to be careful that charts are closed, the material isn't out. This happens so often with very well-intentioned people that they're busy, they leave, some material is left out. Who isn't curious about somebody else's story and is looking at it? And I think that it's not just the violation of that other person's confidentiality, but the feeling that, well, if that's left out, what about my stuff? So I think that maintaining a sense of the place and spaces is critical. Number five, I have payment. Now, this is something, again, this is not such a hard and fast one, as many of them are not. Because, yes, of course, it was talked about yesterday, payment for, what was the situation? Oh, right, that was payment for Shabbat. Sometimes people feel, this happens more in psychiatry, I don't think it happens so much in medicine, but what happens for payment when a patient dies? What if a patient commits suicide, God forbid? Can you charge for sessions, or should you charge for sessions that occurred before? Okay, that's already a really extreme situation. But let's say somebody gives you a gift. Let's say somebody says, well, I'd like to, things are tough, but I'm an accountant, can I do your taxes? Let's say somebody's a hair colorist and it's sort of more intimate, or is a massage therapist. One patient offered to babysit for me if I would, see her for medication. Now, I don't think that there's, when things get intimate, I don't think a massage is ever going to be, really an appropriate transaction for a medical service. But is it inappropriate? I don't know. People had experiences. I think when gifts are intimate or they're wildly extravagant, that's something that needs to be tactfully, always tactfully said, thank you for this, but this is a gift of a nature that I feel would not be good for our relationship. I do basically believe that if the patient gives you a gift that's appropriate, both in terms of the nature of it and the financial whatever, that accepting a gift gracefully, and certainly if you're a psychotherapist, asking about the meaning of it and working with that is the appropriate thing to do. But any thoughts? I know I'm whizzing through quickly. We started a little late, but got to stay with the time. Thoughts about gifts, gift giving, gift accepting? People have experience with this?
All places I've worked, they just say no.
They say no. Okay. But let's say if you're in a private setting, has this been an issue for people? Not so much.
I frequently give a small bit of presentation.
Mm-hmm.
One fellow has an orchid farm, and every time he comes in, he brings a thing of orchids that I take home and plant.
That's nice.
But it's a non-issue.
It's a non-issue. You know what the tougher gift for me is? The food gift. When the patient, I had a patient in culinary school, and she was doing the pastry, course, or whatever, and she came in with these pies and stuff like that, and then she would ask me, well, what did you think of it? And it was really kind of awkward, you know, to deal with the whole, I really didn't, eat it, or whatever, what was I going to say? So that was a little bit of a challenging thing. Okay, six I call casual versus formal. Clothing, language, first or last name. And this here, I think this is a very personal, a stylistic kind of thing, but where at least consistency is a kind of the most important thing. So I absolutely do not think that you need to wear, a white shirt or a blue shirt or a polo shirt or whatever. I think there's obviously some, maybe not obviously, but I do think it's inappropriate to wear wildly casual clothes. However, what I say, this comes up with the rabbinical students, you play ball with your congregants, basketball. Do you go to the locker room with your congregants? Do you do that as a physician? So do you enter into, when you're going to go, to the supermarket, you need to dress up more than you would if you weren't a public person, because as a physician, you are somewhat of a public person. How much of a responsibility do you have? Certainly, I believe as a rabbi, there's a certain level of casualness, which is just uncomfortable. People do want to see, sort of another point, I think this is absolutely true for rabbis, and I do think it's true to a certain degree for physicians, perhaps less so than it used to be, as somewhat other. I think for people to feel that the person caring for them, spiritually or medically, is like competent and solid and is, going to really do the job, they want to feel a certain sense of a little distance. Now, maybe with doctors more than rabbis, I believe, they're willing to, let that distance, relax a little bit. So, come on, let's play a game of racquetball or something like that. But there's still a little bit a re-equilibration that I think does happen in these relationships. Certainly, I believe with clergy, when you enter into these informal, do you go on a camping trip with your rabbi, with your congregants? Do you go, et cetera, et cetera? Do you go to the ski house with the people who you are their nephrologist or something like that? I don't think there's a right or wrong answer, but I do think it needs to be thoughtful. Similarly with names, and I certainly know, in the 30 years or whatever that I've been in practice, the business with names and physicians has changed enormously. And during my residency, people would say, well, if a patient uses your first name, it is a sign of disrespect and a unconscious or conscious wish to sort of denigrate your authority. And, that was like a whole fiesta. It was like a whole field day of discussing the transference and whatever. These days, if some 55-year-old, highly accomplished professional comes in and is talking to me, oftentimes you don't really use names that much if you think about it in your practice, but you're on the phone and you're talking and they say, Michelle, I don't see that anymore as like some big diss, But you can feel it. I think it's something to think about. How do you introduce yourself? When you call a patient on the phone, do I say, this is Dr. Michelle Friedman calling about this? Do I say it's Michelle Friedman, whatever? I think that consistency is kind of an important thing, but I think you want to be mindful about it. I think you might want to ask patients. Sometimes, certainly patients ask me, can I call you, or how do you prefer to be called? And I think this is something to think about. Names, titles, appellations have a great deal of meaning. Self-disclosure. Yes, please.
Just mention something about advice
and comment.
If you call me Barbara as a patient,
right,
I have the right to call you Michelle.
Okay.
So I think people have to think about that.
I think you have to think about it, and I think particularly, oftentimes you would see this, particularly with with senior patients, it feels so disrespectful that some 27-year-old resident is calling particularly demented patients by their first names, and it really feels so off. And I do think that this parity of asking is a reasonable way to go. And you've got to be prepared, if you ask that question, to go with, you know, if the person says, yeah, I feel comfortable, I prefer to call you this, or let's say the person says, I prefer to call you Dr. So-and-so, but you can call me whatever you want, then you have that decision to make. Self-disclosure is a very big topic. In terms of, especially, you know, you're a doctor, you're in the community, people know a lot about you. So if they know difficult information, you have a family member that is going through a very difficult time, medically, personally, whatever, you are getting divorced, you are yourself have a serious illness, and people ask you, well, you know, how did you deal with this? Or I know that such and such, I know this happens a lot, you know, in certainly in the rabbinate. How much information should you disclose? Is helpful to disclose? What if you don't want to disclose it because this is a painful thing and you want to keep it to yourself? This comes up a lot in school, of course, you know, where kids will ask teachers, and they'll ask verbatim also, you know, well, what did you do back in the day? And what if that person did experiment with marijuana or did drink or did whatever their sexual habits were at that point in their life? Is it helpful to disclose that information? You know, I personally believe that 99.9% of the time, nobody wants to know Yenom's Tzuris. They don't want to know, and I actually think it's a huge imposition, and I notice this a lot at Shiva calls, when you go and somebody in the, you know, who's coming to the Unakalov starts telling the story of their experience with the illness situation that the Avil is dealing with. And who wants to hear about somebody else's, you know, whatever, dealings with end stage, whatever it happens to be, or traumatic death, or whatever. It is so distracting. I think what can be helpful to people is what was helpful to you. What resilience was helpful, what resource, not necessarily an ASA, but maybe something. I think it can be very helpful if somebody refers to this, or let's say they don't even know that you have this. But you have a deep sense of reverberation with that person's struggle. Now, we all know that whatever our experience is of something is not the same as somebody else's. So we do have to have a respect for the kind of differential and privacy of that. But I think we can, and often, and we feel like, yeah, I've been there. I know what that felt like for me. And what helped, so you might not say that part. You might keep that part to yourself, but you can say, no, that's something I thought about. That's something I've been through in my own way, and what helped me was X, Y, or Z. That, I believe, can be quite helpful and deeply touching to people. I don't believe that your story, in its gory details, is actually what is helpful. In terms of confidentiality, that is a very, very big topic. Which we really don't have anywhere near adequate time to go into. But there is a lot of, complexity to when people tell you something or they tell your spouse something. This definitely happens in the rabbinate, and I think it happens in the medical field perhaps less, but you can tell me that. Are they expecting it to get to the spouse? If they tell you, if somebody tells you something, you know, about another person, what do you do with that? If somebody, literally on the way here, and I'm not exaggerating, I get a call from one of my former students who's a rabbi in a small city, and he says he doesn't know what to do. I mean, this happens to be a rabbi telling me the story, but it certainly could have been a physician or healthcare professional. He's seeing a guy who's in his late 20s. The guy is messing up in all kinds of ways. He's using drugs. He says he's clean now for 4 weeks. He lost his job. I don't know if that was drug-related, but he lost his job in the educational field. The guy is married. He happens to be married to a healthcare professional. And the guy comes in to the rabbi and tells him that he, and the rabbi has met the wife, but he mostly knows the husband, and they're in couples therapy. I don't know what's going on there, but, you know, whoever knows what's going on in anybody else's therapy. And the guy tells the rabbi that he is having a sexual liaison on a fairly regular basis, since he's unemployed and at home a lot of the time, there are no kids, with a much older woman in his building. So the, and he's planning to go see the fireworks that night with this, or this is the story was, you know, he told me the story happened before, with this woman. So my former student is really feeling very impassioned about this, and he's spending a lot of time talking the guy out of going to see the fireworks, you know, with the lady in the building. But his real question was, what is his obligation to the wife? He knows the wife. I mean, you might, we all have this situation where both members of a couple, or parent and child, are both your patients. Somebody tells you something which certainly has bearing. This wasn't so much, he said, that in terms of the health aspects of it, the guy said that they were, it was safe sex. It wasn't so much an immediate, acute health thing, but what about the obligation to the marriage and to, you know, where do we stand on that? I'm just going to drop that off because I don't want to overdo my time, but I want to get to the last one, a physical contact, which is almost kind of humorous to talk about. I mean, it's really sort of fun to talk about this with a group of doctors because you are in the business of physical contact. You know, when I'm talking to my rabbinical students, you know, it's like a big thing. Like if somebody is, you know, is acutely grieving and they put their hand out to the rabbi, a woman, let's say. But you know, there's a thing we should be sensitive to with men as well. You know, do you shake off that? Do you give them a little speech at that moment about Shomer Nagia? Oh, obviously you wouldn't at that moment. What do you do? However, you're in the business of examining people in the most intimate ways, unless you're, you know, radiologists or ophthalmologists, and you know, what are you doing below the eyeballs or whatever? You know, you are in the business of physically touching your patients all the time. But there's touch and there's touch. And I think that we know the difference between the touch of a physical exam, not that that can't be experienced by either the patient or the doctor with a lot of fantasy or a lot of excitement or whatever. It certainly can be. And I think we need to be mindful of that. That's back to my sine curve, is when are you really looking forward to doing this exam or, you know, whoever it happens to be or whatever. But the that's a separate thing, or it's a related thing. But outside of the physical exam, you know, where are we in terms of touch? You know, somebody related to me earlier in the conference that he felt that he had made a mistake with a patient who was a patient who was terminal. But as I said earlier, I don't think we want to deprive either the very elderly or the terminal of their feelings of sensuality and of wish for contact and such. So it's not like all those feelings all of a sudden are totally or whatever, or little by little are gone completely from that population. But this person said that this woman over at the end of the visit, she wanted to hug him, and he said he felt uncomfortable with that, and he felt that that impaired very much the nature of the care that he gave. Now, you know, I can't say that what he did was a wrong thing. I'm talking about this from a caregiving point of view. Maybe it's what he needed to do to maintain whatever distance he needed to maintain, not just from the romantic or intimations of that feelings, or maybe he needed to not engage in that because he needed to have that separation in the work of the dying patient, which obviously has its own complicated aspects to it. But the whole issue of touch outside of the physical exam, the aspects to that, is really quite complicated. And when somebody is grieving, or somebody is shocked, or somebody is, you know, leaning in with some sort of contact, you know, I think that we said yes earlier, we say no now. I think it's really quite different and quite challenging for physicians who, as I said, are very much in the business of touch. I think now I have hit my 45 minutes, even though I'm starting late. So let's just open it up to any thoughts, you know, on this whole area of boundaries and borders. Please, yes.
I just want to elaborate on what you said about first names and things like this.
Yes, first names.
I feel that in general, the patient will respond. It's more like you are the actor and they are the reactor. And I think it applies to pretty much everything you have said, at least generally. I give you an example that I've experienced is with people saying curse words.
Okay,
so
right.
I'm from California, and it's, I don't know how it's in New York, but over there, every second word
in
is a
four-letter
word. And I've had people comment how they shout from my office. They don't hear that. I've been practicing for 28 years. I've had one guy use it one time, and I told them to stop. But the reason I think it's because if I'm speaking to them in a certain way, they will respond in a certain way. As far as first names, in my form, one of the things that I take in the intake is how would you like to be called?
Oh, that's interesting. You put it on.
I have their name, and then I say, how would you like to be called? And then we try our best to call them the way you want to be called.
Interesting. Uh-huh.
But I find like this physical thing and all of that, I think especially as a woman doctor, it's really about the doctor taking responsibility that it is his or her territory, and they're going to run it the way they want to run it.
If you put it in your form, you have taken my main theme of being mindful of this to the best limit possible. You've clearly done it. You've put it in your form, and there's no doubt in my mind that the tone that you set, either by maybe you never even told one guy once. Not use curse words, but the language that you use, or even saying if somebody is cursing every, other syllable, saying, I find that, I once did this in a, it was like in a CVS or some kind of supermarket, and there were a bunch of kids, or teenagers, and they were, like, every other word was like really, I just somehow said, it's really hard to know what you kids, and they had nothing to do with me, but I just said it, what you kids are actually talking about, because there's no variation. Like, I'm thinking, how these kids are going to get a job or function in the world? There's completely no expressivity. But I think you can communicate to people. It looked at me like I was completely out of my mind, and I was ready to get shot or something, but it was okay. But I think when you communicate to people, I want to hear what you have to say, and these are empty words, which is what you did, and you have done for 26 years without even saying it. It is profoundly effective because you've thought about it, you've made it your intention. Other responses? Wait, let me give somebody, anybody else a thought? Back there? Yes, Gila.
Just a question about boundaries and time. So again, the problem with being in a small community is that people send the kids to the same school, they have your phone number.
Right.
So sometimes you get calls for emergencies, which of course you have to deal with, and other times you get calls for, my husband's had a sore throat for an hour, but we're leaving tomorrow, can we come over and do a strep test?
Right.
How can you, so on the one hand, you want to be the resource to this community. On the other hand, you want to protect your family time.
Right.
You want to protect your boundaries.
Right.
How do you balance?
Okay, so I have two thoughts about that. If we had more time, I would really like to hear you bat it about. I think when people come up to you in a non-medical setting, like there you are, at the local supermarket, and they tell you something that's intense, which people often do, which is kind of the equivalent of a hand on the doorknob, I just got a terrible diagnosis or a terrible whatever. There, I think you can say, I appreciate that this is a really serious matter, and I don't feel that I can give it the proper respect. In this setting, can you meet such and such? I believe it's true. I mean, it is an intrusion into your private life, but it's also a really serious matter that you really can't think about next to cantaloupes or whatever, and you're not going to do a good job of it. However, the sore throat does not fit into that category, and there I think it's the same kind of thing as what you were saying, is that you need to educate your community gracefully and firmly over time, that in order, I can understand that you'd really like to have that strep test now, and you're leaving for whatever, and so, but it becomes hard for me to really do this, my job well, when I have these kinds of, whatever outside things, and it's important for me to keep that kind of practice to the office. Now, and I say this to my students, everybody goes in, well, hopefully people go into the rabbit, and all certainly into medicine, because you want to do good, you want to heal, whatever. And it's hard to feel like you're not being a nice guy or a nice person. But ultimately, you got to believe that you're going to be a better nice guy if you maintain boundaries that protect you, over time, so that you'll want to continue to do this work. And what was that? I think I'm sure that Rabbi Weinreb's material is going to touch to some degree on some of these issues. So I am going to depart for and enjoy listening to your talk. Thank you.